The year 1947. Any significance come to your mind about that year, 1947? Some of you old geezers might have been born that year. You were born that year? Anybody else born that year? Well, I was 6 years old in 1947, so there. but aside from it being the birthday year of Tom Lydier, could there be much more significance to the year than that? But can you think of anything else that might have been particularly significant about 1947? I'll get into that in just a minute. Yeah, 1947, 2 years after the end of World War II, the world was just kind of settling back down into a peace that was still a little tenuous. The Cold War was revving up. Former allies were now becoming enemies. Estimates range in World War II of anywhere from 50 million to over 70 million people were killed. Hundreds of thousands of people were displaced, and things were just beginning to settle down. But 1947 did mark a turning point in history, and there were several things that happened, one in particular that the world paid attention to. The others that, kind of did not make too much news, particularly not in 1947. Later on, it made a little bit of news from time to time. But the big thing was what was happening in the Middle East during that period of time. Prior to World War II, a good part of the Middle East was controlled by Turkey. After the end of World War II, Turkey was out of the Middle East. Britain had controlled part of the Middle East, particularly Egypt, Suez Canal, that area. But basically, the whole Middle East had to be rearranged. Britain played a major role. I think the United States a lesser role in deciding what the shape of the Middle East would look like. There was a lot of negotiation between some powerful tribal leaders in different parts of the Middle East. And so some agreements were made, some before the end of the war, in order to get the support of some of the Arab soldiers and the Arab tribes and so forth. And so we ended up with a bunch of countries with kind of artificial boundaries, like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, Iran, Lebanon. So all these countries who were kind of random boundaries to meet political ends more than anything else. And then there was Palestine. And, of course, the UN was formed at the end of World War II. And Britain became the authority of Palestine. They governed Palestine, and it was referred to as the British Mandate from the UN, that they governed Palestine. And in 1947, towards the end of the year, as a matter of fact, in November 29th of 1947, the UN adopted a resolution for a plan to partition Palestine, basically to break up Palestine into two states. The Israeli section and an Arab section. So the United States basically established, the nine nations basically established the nation of Israel at that time. Now, the vote was made, the decision was made, but it didn't actually go into effect until May 15th of 1948. But that was the decision. Now, as soon as that decision was made, Arabs and Jews immediately started fighting. There were quite a few riots. Jews had you might say, communities all through the Middle East. They've been there for thousands of years, some. you know, places like Alexander and Egypt was a Jewish community that went back to the days of Jeremiah after the fall of Judah. Some Jews fled to Egypt and established a community there in Alexandria. Aleppo in Syria, which I'll talk about more in a few minutes, had a very long, had a community of Jews for a very long period of time, well before Christ. Some claim that went all the way back to the time of David. So there were various, the area of Babylon had the large Jewish community and so forth. So these were scattered all around, and so there were a lot of riots and so forth that followed this UN resolution. But the British were still in charge until that next May. Now, one big question is what to do with all the displaced Jews. A lot of them wanted to come to Israel. Britain, during the years after the war, would not let Jews migrate to Israel. They wanted to keep things calm so they wouldn't. So what happened is a large smuggling network evolved to smuggle Jews into Israel. And so the British were trying to keep Jews from coming into Israel. The people in Israel and the Jewish communities around the Middle East were trying to get Jews out of the various Arab areas and into to Israel. And so this was going on for several years. And then the fighting started immediately the next day after the UN vote. Arabs started fighting Jews, destroying synagogues, moving into Jewish areas of cities, rioting, tearing up, setting fires to stores and things of that nature. And so all this began to happen. Now, what did the partition look like that the UN voted on? You can see it up here. On this slide, this is the Palestine area. brown area there is the Arab partitions, and this kind of bluish green area here was the Jewish part. Now, when you look at that, do you see any potential problems with this kind of arrangement? You've got the Arab sections here, down here, and down there, and not all connected. And then here's Jerusalem right here. This is supposed to be an open city. And so that was what the UN voted on. Well, on May 14th, David Ben-Gurion declared the state of Israel. And the next day, Arab armies from Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, which is what Jordan was called at that time, and Iraq all entered the Palestine Mandate area. And so a year-long war broke out. Now, this war resulted in a change in the boundaries, and about a year later, in late 1949, a truce was declared. And this is what it looked like at the end when the truce was declared. Now, this light area here was what was the Jewish area. These grayer areas there were the Arab areas. And so that's the boundaries. And Jerusalem, you can see, is right in that little place right there, which was kind of half occupied by Israel, half occupied by the Arabs. And let me throw up the previous one side by side here so you can kind of see roughly the same scale. And so you can see what happened. Israel made out pretty good because this large area had shrunk down considerably. You can see that a lot of this area disappeared. The Gaza Strip still was there. They did lose the Golan Heights were gone, but this area became Jewish. You can see over here. And so there was some shifting of borders, but you might say an uneasy truce was made. Now, of course, this map here Also shows what happened in the Six-Day War, which was in 1967. The Golan Heights, all the West Bank, Sinai, all that was captured by Israel during the Six-Day War. But before, prior to that, that light area was the Israeli territory, the Arab territories, after the peace accord that had a ceasefire in 1949. Okay, so so that started the Middle East on a course that has continued to this day and will probably continue till Christ returns. So certainly that was a major turning point. Another thing happened, though, in 1947. It took several years before even word of this even spread around to any significant degree, and that is the first of the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Some Arab boys playing around in some caves stumbled across some old pottery, some broken, some I think intact. There were some old scrolls there. They took a few pieces, took them into a nearby town, sold them for a pittance. It passed through several different hands over a period of several years before it got into the hands of a Jewish scholar who recognized it as being extremely old. He began to track down, and over a period of some years, they eventually discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. We're going to talk more about those Dead Sea Scrolls in a minute here. But there's one other thing that happened that is kind of related to the subject I'm going to be talking about today that happened in 1947. And that was the oldest, most detailed, and considered by the Jews to be the most accurate accurate Old Testament in existence, which had been in Aleppo, Syria, for nearly 500 years, began a strange journey from Aleppo to the Jewish Museum in Israel that took about a decade for that to happen. And this was a very valuable Old Testament complete book, a complete version of the Old Testament that was actually put together around 900 AD. So it went back that far. So you have then the, and those are the two oldest versions we have of the Old Testament. The one from Aleppo and the Dead Sea Scrolls. One began a strange trail that ended up in Israel. The other was discovered in 1947. I want to talk more about both of those in a few minutes. Now, let's talk about Aleppo and the Old Testament that's found there. You can see from the map, Aleppo is up in northern part of Syria, not too far from the Mediterranean Sea, not too far from Turkey, close to that area. Now, what happened in 1947 is that Aleppo, the synagogue there, a very old synagogue, that was where this particular Old Testament was stored. It's often referred to as the Aleppo Codex. Codex is another word for book rather than scroll. The scrolls were rolled up. At some point, they began to copy the Old Testament on sheets of paper. And thus they referred to them as codexes. So it's referred to as the Aleppo Codex. The Jews referred to it as the Aleppo Crown, or just the Crown, because it was the the oldest Old Testament in existence. Now, and like I said, around 900 A.D. was when that Aleppo Codex was put together. But what happened was, after the day after they announced the partition of Palestine, the rioting occurred, and it occurred in Aleppo. and they burnt down the, not burned down, but they set fire to the main Aleppo synagogue. And the codex was back in a back room in a small safe. They went in there and ransacked the place, scattered the codex all over the floor of the synagogue, tried to set fire to the synagogue, and left it. And the Jewish leaders came in as soon as it was safe and saw the codex all over the place. Apparently the rioters had no idea what they had in their hands when they had that codex. But they gathered all the pages back together, and they didn't know exactly what to do with them. So what they did is they decided that for the immediate time, they would give it to a well-known community leader. But it wasn't safe to leave it with him too long because of the war and so forth going on. There was constant fighting and possibility of losing the codex. And so what they did is there was a trusted Christian merchant that they had dealt with, and they asked him if he would hold the codex and keep it safe, and he agreed to. And so they gave it to this merchant, and he kept it for a while, and they spread the story that the codex was lost in the fire, so that nobody would come looking for it and try to find it or anything. So they said, yeah, it was burned up when the synagogue was burned. And a little later on, this Jewish merchant transferred it to a Jewish merchant. It went from a Christian merchant back to a Jewish merchant who kept it for 10 years there in the Aleppo area. And what happened was that they eventually decided, we've got to get it out of Aleppo. The Jewish community was dying there because of everything that was going on. And so they wanted to get it out of the area, and so they contacted, there was a cheese merchant there that was doing business between Syria and Turkey. He smuggled it out. And in Turkey, then, they met some Israeli Jewish agent, and eventually it found its way to sea, down the coast to Israel, and eventually found its way into a museum for historical artifacts. Now, the problem was that between the time it left Aleppo and to the time it, sometime after it reached the museum, 40% of the codex disappeared. It was gone. And the mystery of what happened to that 40% remains to this day, but there are some recent investigations have pretty much pointed to where what likely happened to it. But all the first five books, the Torah, those were missing. And then different portions of the rest of the text were missing. So quite a bit of it was lost. It ended up at the Ben Ziva Institute, and it got there in 1958. What likely happened was one of two things. This Jewish agent in Turkey, he was Turkish, but he was Jewish, that was involved in the smuggling and getting it down to Israel, he might have taken it. But the more likely thing is that the museum director at the Ben Ziv Institute probably stole it. What happened was that this was the fact that some of these pages were discovered missing, or 40% of it was discovered missing, was kept quiet and was never revealed to anybody for 20 years or more. You know, the new state of Israel and so forth, there's a lot of things going on. They didn't want a scandal, but it turned out that later on some other people had historic things that they had donated to the same institute, and they had disappeared. And eventually the director of the institute was fired, but never charged with anything. And so the suspicion is that it was probably stolen by this Jewish official that ran the institute, along with a number of other artifacts. So a good part of this priceless Old Testament was missing. Now, what does it have to do with anything that I'm talking about today? Well, I'm just giving you a little background, maybe too much background, but leading into the topic I want to talk to you about today, and that is proof of God and fulfilled prophecy as proof of God. What happened, those of you who keep up with a lot of things on the Life, Hope, and Truth website know that I've been one of the writers of the God section of Life, Hope, and Truth, and we've written a lot of articles in Life, Hope, and Truth for proof of the Bible and proof of God and that sort of thing. And about a year ago, I was contacted by one of the editors and said, well, we want to put together a booklet on proof of God. And we're asking several people who had been involved in some of this writing to give some suggestions on what should be in it and so forth. And so I spent some time and wrote about a two-page email that I sent back describing what I thought should be in it, on what sources we had from the various writings that would fit into each proof, suggested a number of authors that could contribute to it, and including myself. And I sent it in, and nothing happened. 4 or 5 months later, I hadn't heard anything. I figured they'd decided to do some other things and put off that. And then one day I got an email from this editor, and he said, we liked your ideas. When can you start? But they weren't at that point interested in a booklet. They wanted to do a series in Discern magazine. And so I began writing articles. The first one came out in the November-December issue of Discern. And just right after Thanksgiving, I turned in my fourth one in the series. So for the next few issues, there'll be at least four proofs of God coming up. And the fourth one was on fulfilled prophecy. And so in my doing my research for that, these Discern articles are fairly short, about 1,500 words, which is about 3 pages if you include the artwork and so forth that usually goes with it. So they're fairly short, and I had a lot more material than that. So I said, okay, I'll give some sermons on that. And so that's what we're talking about. But I want to begin talking about this by giving you a quote. You know, the group that seems to be least impressed by the idea that there is a God are intellectuals and scientists. They believe that everything is natural, everything evolved, life just sprang up, you know, all this kind of thing. And so they really don't accept God, and they get very angry at people who try to prove that God exists. And they like to cast dispersions, make fun of. And in one individual's book, his name is Jerry Coyne, and he wrote a book called Faith Versus Fact, Why Science and Religion Are Incompatible. And so he got a whole book about why there's no God, that it's all science. But at one point in his book, he said, here's what it would take for me to believe that there's a God. And so he wrote down what it would take to convince him that there was a God. Okay. Now, he went through a lot of things in his book to talk about, well, can you really prove anything without science? You know, but what does it mean, before I give that quote, what does it mean to prove God exists? You know, you could say, well, your eyewitnesses, if they're reliable. Yeah, you know, but most of our eyewitnesses are gone, like Moses. You know, we can believe what is written, but we can't really cross-examine him or anything like that. And so, yeah, there's a lot of people be skeptical about something like that. And there are a lot of kooks who might claim they've seen God and so forth. physical evidence, and that's what the first three articles on proof of God was in Discern, that will appear in Discern. You know, things like the origin of the universe, the origin of life, design of the universe, things like that. That's physical evidence. That's good proof. But these kind of things generally fall in the area of circumstantial evidence. You know, so it's kind of hard to prove to the world through circumstantial evidence, particularly people who don't want to believe. And personally, it's a little easier. For example, experiencing miracles. And I dare say a good number of you have experienced what you would consider personally a miracle in your life at different times. And that's a good personal proof, but you got to try to convince somebody else, yeah, I was healed, that's just the body taking care of itself. You know, people would dismiss the things that you know was direct God's intervention. So that's kind of hard to prove to other people. That way. And the same thing, if you personally saw God, that would be good proof. But God's not revealing himself to people. But let me go back to Jerry Coyne. And Jerry is a professor specializing in evolutionary genetics at University of Chicago. And here's what he said it would take for him to believe in God. He said, suppose that a bright light appeared in the heavens and supported by winged angels, a being clad in a white robe and sandals descended onto my campus from the sky, accompanied by a pack of apostles bearing the names given in the Bible, loud heavenly music with blaring trumpets is heard everywhere. The robed being who identifies himself as Jesus repairs to the nearby university hospital and instantly heals many severely afflicted people, including amputees. And then he goes on to write, after a while, Jesus and his minions, supported by angels, ascend back into the sky with another chorus of music. The heavens swiftly darken. There is flashes of lightning, pearls of thunder, and in an instant, the sky is clear. If this were all witnessed by others and documented by video, and if the healings were unexplainable but supported by the testimony from multiple doctors, and if all the apparitions and events conform to Christian theology, then I'd have to start thinking seriously about the truth of Christianity. Really? That's all it would take? Now, you see something in this. You know, just the way it's written, Jesus and his minions, a pack of apostles, and this all the way through his book is that same tone. You know, he does not like Christians or anybody that thinks there's a God for that matter. But this is what it would take for him to believe in God. Of course, any scientific evidence is not nearly as complete as this would be. But one thing is that I do find interesting as I was reading through this quote. He's not too far off on what's going to happen. Is he? I mean, you know, it's going to happen. You know, he's off a little bit. It's going to be a pack of angels, not a pack of apostles following him down. The healing will take place because there's going to be a resurrection of dead people. If that's not a healing, I don't know what is, into spirit beings. So there will be some big healings taking place at that time. But he's not going to be accepted, and so people like Mr. Coyne are going to fight him. But it's kind of interesting. He's got a little bit of an idea of what really is going to happen, and it won't convince him and all the rest. Even that won't convince them. You know, so what we might look at, well, what are some of the reasons for rejecting fulfilled prophecy? You know, the Bible is full of prophecies. What are some of the reasons for rejecting it? Because, you know, a lot of people do. They scoff at Bible prophecies. They reject it. And one of the things that they say that the books have been cooked. The books have been cooked in that it was written not only after the prophecies were given, but after the prophecies were fulfilled, they went back and filled it in so it would really work. You know, they cooked the books. They went and edited it after the events actually happened. And so that's one of the things. But we look at Romans 3 in verses 1 and 2, where Paul is asking, what advantage then has the Jew, or what is the profit of circumcision? Much in every way, chiefly because to them were committed the oracles of God. And so here Paul is pointing out that the Jews had a specific responsibility. Going back, all the way back to the ancient Israel, to the time of Moses, of keeping the oracles of God. For some time that was oral. And then they began to write things down. And sometimes things would get lost and so forth. But it was through the Jews that they had this responsibility. We do know from the Bible, like in 2 Kings 22 and verse 8, this is in the time of Josiah's reign in Jerusalem and around 611 B.C., sometime around that time. Then Hilkiah, the high priest, said to Shaphan, the scribe, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, and he read it. And so the book had been lost. It's kind of temple had kind of gotten run down and so forth and been lost, and they found it. So we know that it goes way back. The Old Testament, and I'm focusing on the Old Testament here today. But the skeptics, they say, no, it's just they're cooking the books. But, you know, we know by the 5th century the Torah was complete in good form. By the time of Christ, the Old Testament had been codified for hundreds of years. And I think the probably the best proof of the Old Testament is the Word of God is Christ. Because if the Old Testament at the time of Christ had not been accurate, would not Jesus have corrected it? Can we really believe that there were some significant errors in the Old Testament at the time of Christ? That Christ was saying, don't worry about that. Don't believe that one. Wouldn't he have corrected it? But what did he do? He quoted it. He quoted the New Testament over and over again. He said, I didn't come to destroy it. He said, I didn't come to destroy the law and the prophets. That's not why I'm here. Of course, nobody believes that today. They think that's exactly why he came, to get rid of the law. But, he said, no, he said, yeah, it's right. The book is right. You know, so all of this passed down, you know, the scribes, when they were exiled in Babylon, a lot of the writings were formalized, put together in ancient scripts. It was preserved by the Talmudists from about 70 to 500 A.D., then preserved by Jewish scholars called the Masoretes until about 916 B.C. And matter of fact, that's when the Aleppo Codex was written, right around 916 B.C., by a group of these Masoret scholars in the area of Tiberias. Now, this particular codex was not just the Old Testament. It was designed to be, and apparently the first of its kind, it was designed to be a study Bible, a reference Bible. And so it was put together very carefully with notes in the margins, with a lot of coding to explain what it really meant, because there's some problems with Hebrew. There's some problems with reading Hebrew, and part of those problems is that they don't use vowels. They don't separate words. You know, there's a lot of problems there. And so this was designed to be such a reference that it would make sure that none of these kind of things interfered with the true understanding of the Old Testament. So it's a very valuable book. That's why it was called The Crown. The most important translation, the Jews of modern times, that is the most important translation that still exists of the Old Testament. And so what happened generally when the problem was, and this got better by around 900, it got better starting at that time, it began to get better, but they didn't have good paper and they didn't have good ink. And so things simply didn't last. And so they fell apart, they disintegrated, they faded. And so they had to make new ones all the time. And the people that did this were basically people who were trained to be scribes, who were trained to do this. And so they made new copies and then they destroyed the old ones because they were worn out, couldn't be used. And so they were destroyed. You know, not so the Codex, because it was designed for something else. Now, when they had to copy it, they did the normal reviews that you might review if you were copying something. But then they went back and did things like counted the letters in each line. They did things like number of times the various letters occurred on a page. They did things like the middle word of each line to make sure that it matched. They did very thorough checking to make sure the copy was an exact of the original being copied. Now, here's a picture of the Aleppo Codex, open to one page. This codex was the most ancient text that we know of prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it was the oldest. The Aleppo Jews were very protective of this codex. What happened is it kind of made its rounds to end up in Aleppo around 500, around 1500 AD is when it ended up in Aleppo. But they became very possessive of it, and it became like a relic, a good luck charm. They kept it in a safe. They kept it locked up. They never opened it practically at all. They would not let scholars come in and even look at it. During World War II in 1942, some scholars from Jerusalem came and begged them to let them at least look at it. They said no. They said, well, let us take photographs of the pages so we can take it back and study it. They said no. It was their good luck charm, and that's what they treated it like. And so they hid it from Jewish scholars. They hid it from the world, which was sad that that happened. But that's what it was. Now look at a closer view of this. You can see it was written in three columns. And if you recall, this right edge is lined up because they wrote from right to left. And so you can see that it's not lined up on the other side there. You also see that it's all kind of run together. You don't see breaks appear breaks between words. What you do see, you see all these little dots and dashes and double dots and all kinds of little stuff here? That's the kind of things that they put in there to designate where vowels go, where words break, that sort of thing. That's what that's about. And then up at the top, you see here, you see some things down in the margins. These are all additional notes and so forth. The goal was to have a Bible, Old Testament, that that was exact and could not be misread. Now, this Bible, as I said, was first put together in Tiberias. By Jewish scholars there in around 916. There were some upheavals in Tiberias a little bit later. And so it's moved to Jerusalem. And then the Crusaders attacked in 1099. The Crusaders sacked Jerusalem, and so the Codex was taken out and moved to Cairo, where there was a strong Jewish community. It stayed in Cairo until around 1479, when there was an Egyptian upheaval, and it was moved to Aleppo. So that's how it got to Aleppo. And it was taken care of. It was protected very well until it reached Aleppo. Now, you know, I mentioned the problem with ancient Hebrew writing. No vowels, no spacing between words. So how does that work if you're translating? Well, I'm going to show you a well-known phrase from the Bible that has no vowels and no spacing between words. That's how it looks. Now, you might begin to set some signs and guess what this is. Now, let's make it a little bit simpler by let's at least breaking it up into words. What do you think? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Now, of course, that was not from the Old Testament, but it's the most well-known phrase in all the Bible. But you see the problem when you run words together and you throw out the vowels. And that's the way the Codex was, and all Hebrew writing, ancient Hebrew writing was. And so they brought the Aleppo Codex was to make sure that somebody didn't mistranslate in the future, is basically what that was. So very, very valuable book of the Old Testament. Now, then there's the Dead Sea Scrolls, found in a cave. Over the years, they ended up finding there were 11 caves that had these scrolls. There were 223 biblical texts that they found, fragments from all books except Esther, complete scroll of Isaiah and the Psalms. Now, this is really a treasure chest. Here's a view of the Dead Sea Scroll, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You can see it looks a little different. First, it's not divided up into separate columns. Just one column, basically. Another thing about these scrolls were, it's not clear that they were actually copied by the traditional Jewish scribes, because this group that where these Dead Sea Scrolls were found were the Essenes. They were a sect that pulled away from the regular Jewish faith and were separated from them. And so these scrolls might have been copied by the Essenes from some of the Masoret texts. But if you take a little closer look here at some of these scrolls, notice, you know, all those dots and stuff that it was appearing, you don't see much of that here. You do see, it looks like maybe some spacing for words here. So it's a little different, but it may not have been what you might say passed copied down through the official Jewish scribe network, but it's been found to be pretty accurate. So what do we have about the books being cooked? Well, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, as I said, they were able to date them back to around 200 B.C. up to around the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., found in 47. The Qumran community of separated Jews, the Essenes. Some near-complete scrolls, but thousands of fragments. The book of Isaiah, word for word, identity at 95%. There was a complete book of Isaiah, pretty much all the Psalms were found, 95% accuracy. You know, so Basically, the case that the books were cooked is very weak because you have three things. You have Christ in year zero, you know, the transition between AD and BC, who would have corrected the Old Testament if it was in error then. Then you have an Aleppo Code that was written around 1000 AD. You have the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were written, you know, right around the time of Christ or so. And so you have this continuum, and they all agree. They haven't changed. So it's pretty safe to say that the Old Testament that we have is very, very accurate. It's the same, basically the same Old Testament that Christ had. Now, another thing that the skeptics say is that, look, you're reading these prophecies all wrong. The prophecies only referred to immediate events. You know, like the Assyrians were massed on the border, and Isaiah said, they're going to attack. Of course they're going to attack. I think there's a prophet to say that. You know, it's that kind of thing, that they were immediate events that anybody could have figured out that lived at that time. You know, let's look at an example here that's found in Isaiah 7, beginning in verse 10 through 13. What's happening here is that Syria and Israel became allied and were about to invade Jerusalem, or about to invade Judah, excuse me. Ahaz was the king of Judah at that time. He appealed to Assyria for help. Okay, so you have Assyria, which was kind of a big superpower up to the north. You had Syria, you had Israel, the northern ten tribes, then you had Judah, kind of stacked up like that from north to south. And so Syria and Israel are going to invade Judah. So Ahaz says, well, look, we can solve this problem. We'll just get Assyria to ally with us. And so when that happened, when Ahaz appealed to Assyria for help, Assyria responded. They invaded Syria and Israel. And that was when the first deportation of the northern ten tribes began. And they were carried away in captivity first in 734 B.C. or around that time. The final one was in 721 B.C. But that was the Assyrians that did that. And so that ended that. But they also started messing around with Judah. They never captured Jerusalem, but they invaded the lands. They took captives and so forth. And Judah found themselves paying the Assyrians to not destroy them, that sort of thing. So that's the setting here in Isaiah 7, verse 10. And God, Isaiah here is talking to Ahaz, and he says, moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, through Isaiah, of course, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I'll not ask, nor will I test the Lord. You know, here, God is giving Ahaz saying, you want a proof that there's a God? Ask, just tell me what you want. Ahaz said, no. You know, it's kind of a rebellious attitude when a prophet of God says do that. Then Isaiah said, hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will you weary my God also? You know, so he goes on here in beginning in verse 14. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Curds and honey he shall eat, and he may know that he may know to refuse evil and choose good. For the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose good. The land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. So here was a prophecy that came out of this. In this context, Jerusalem didn't fall at that time, but much of the land of Judah did fall. and was controlled by Syria as a result of that. Now, this prophecy is talking about something that was going to happen, and that the land was going to be eventually forsaken by our kings. It's going to be gone. This part of this is more of the immediate. Some of it is longer term. But some of the skeptics say, well, this wasn't about Jesus Christ. This is about Hezekiah. Hezekiah was the one being talked about here. That's the argument. It was Hezekiah, who was a pretty good king by the standards of the time. But the main question here is, did he refuse evil and always choose good? No, he didn't. This person refused evil. Not sometimes, he simply refused evil. So he could have been talking about Hezekiah. But this is the kinds of arguments that are sometimes made. Yeah, it's talking about more immediate events. Some virgin was pregnant, she had a child, can it not be Hezekiah? That sort of thing. We look at this, and yet we see a verification in Matthew 1:22-23. So all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, "Behold, the virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," which is translated "God with us." Now, this was when the angel appeared to Joseph to explain what was going on. When he found out that his fiancée, his betrothed, was pregnant. So the New Testament verifies that Isaiah, indeed, that was a prophecy of Christ. But even if, for the sake of argument, say, all right, it's a prophecy of Hezekiah. You can say, well, was it false? Wasn't Hezekiah a good king? So these kinds of arguments that don't really hold much weight. And then there's a demand for historical evidence. We need to see it somewhere besides the Bible. That's kind of hard because there's practically no written ancient history. For it to be preserved today, it basically had to either be carved in stone or written in clay tablets that were then cooked to preserve them. And a few societies did some of that, but not much. So we have very little written records, going back in B.C. times, before Christ. Not much there. So there's very little written. The archaeological evidence is very scarce. The evidence available is, what we've discovered, the archaeological evidence, the written evidence we have discovered, seems to always be consistent with the Bible. Sometimes they'll find something and say, aha, here it is, but then the further investigation turns out, it's consistent with the Bible. So it always seems to be consistent. One of those famous libraries in ancient times was the Library of Alexander. What's a Jewish community there? What happened? Burned down. All that was gone. So that's what we see happening. So another thing that they say, prophecies are vague and can be interpreted in several different ways. Well, I can't argue with the fact that some of the prophecies are very vague. Psalm 69, verse 9, I'm breaking into a sentence here. "Because the zeal for your house has eaten me up, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me." Now you read Psalm 69, and you say, of course, that's a prophecy about Christ. How would you ever know that? Unless somebody told you. John 2 and verse 17, when Christ went in and turned over the money changers' tables and cleared out all the mess that was going on there in front of the temple, then his disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." We'd not have known that that would have been a prophecy if we had been told in the New Testament. So some are vague. That doesn't mean they're false. You just have to know them. And so we can look at some of these prophecies about the Messiah. Matter of fact, a good time to do so, because they're sprouting out all over the place this time of the year. But you know, nobody thinks about what it really means that you're taking these ancient texts. And there's no question that all of the New Testament was finished by the time of Christ. The books haven't been jimmied since then. It was all before that. And you go back and all these things, you know, it goes back to Genesis. Genesis 12 and verse 3, I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and in all the families of the earth, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. How could all the families of the earth be blessed in anybody but Abraham's offspring, Jesus Christ? That's why in Matthew they give the lineage of Christ. And in Matthew is through Joseph, the legal lineage. And Luke, the lineage is traced back through Mary, the biological lineage. They all go all the way back to Abraham. But who could bless all the families on earth except Jesus Christ? It was a prophecy of Jesus Christ going all back to Genesis. Numbers 24, verse 17. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel and batter the brow of Moab and destroy all the sons of Tumah. Well, that prophecy has not been fulfilled completely. Christ did come, but he hasn't done the destroying all the sons of Tumah until the second coming. And that's part of the problem with people reading these prophecies, particularly the Jews. Because even though the more you look at these prophecies, the more it becomes clear that Christ is coming twice, not once. And unless you understand that, none of these prophecies make sense. You know, none of it makes sense unless you understand that. In Genesis 49, and verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of all people. That's talking about two things. The first coming of Christ, the second coming of Christ. First time as a human, second time as ruling king. Shiloh is translated as one to whom it belongs. Now, last word in this phrase, the obedience of the people, is often translated obedience of the nations. Now, look at Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7. Certainly a very famous scripture. For to us a child is born, and to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it, to establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. So again, it's talking about two things here. Talking about Christ's birth as a human and Christ's return as a ruling king. And unless you understand that part of it, then how do Jews explain the scripture? You know, what they thought, someone's going to rise up and be a great soldier, a leader, and defeat Rome, and that sort of thing. You know, that's what they thought. But how do you explain it? And things like his name will be called Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father. In John 10, verse 30, it says, I and my Father are one. They're one. You know, so it makes sense for these terms to be used. He's God. Look at Micah 5, 2. But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, Though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from the old, from everlasting. So here, he's going to come from Bethlehem. Now, that's a pretty specific prophecy. Look at Isaiah 53 and verse 1. As a matter of fact, if you're flipping through your Bible, we're going to stay in Isaiah 53 for a couple of minutes here as I jump around. Isaiah 53 and verse 1, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And then if we look at John 12, verses 37 and 38, this prophecy, nobody's going to believe him. But it says here in John 12, verse 37, but although he has done so many signs before them, they did not believe him, that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been extended? Now, Christ extended his arm to basically two groups at that time. One was the religious leaders, and the other was to a group of called out ones, a pretty small group of called out ones as it ended up at that time. Of course, since he's extended his arms to many, including us. But this was part of the fulfillment. Back to Isaiah 53 and verse 2 and 3. For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Now, again, it's talking about Christ's first coming. John 1:11, he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. In Luke 23, verse 18, Pilate is speaking here, I will therefore chastise him and release him, for it was necessary for him to release one of them at the feast. And they all cried out at once, saying, away with this man, and release Barabbas. They rejected him, just like the prophecy said in Isaiah. Back to Isaiah 53, verses 4 through 6. Surely he has borne our griefs, carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, the chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we are like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Yeah, that's talking about the man, Jesus Christ, not the returning spirit being, Jesus Christ. Romans 5, verses 6 and 8. For when we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. Verse 8, but God demonstrates his own love towards us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. See, that's the part that the Jews never figured out from looking at these prophecies. That, yeah, Christ was going to come, our Savior, and he was going to die for us. Be resurrected, and then he was going to come back at another time. They never made that connection. The prophecies, how can you interpret these prophecies without understanding that? Isaiah 53, verses 7 and 8, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people, he was stricken. Now, here again. Then Pilate asked him, saying, do you answer nothing, seeing how many things they testify against you? But Jesus still answered nothing. So that Pilate marveled. He didn't try to defend himself because he knew what he was doing. He was making the sacrifice. Isaiah 53, verse 9. And they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death, because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. But he was with the rich at his death. Of course, that's described in Matthew 27, verses 57 through 60. Now when evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself also had become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate, asked for the body of Jesus. He must have been a very influential person for Pilate to even agree to this. Then Pilate commanded that the body be given to him, and when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in clean linen cloth, laid it in a new tomb, which had been hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb and departed. Again, another fulfillment there. Isaiah 53, verses 10 and 11. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When you make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days. And the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. And he shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied by his knowledge. My righteous servant shall justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. So here it's talking about bearing the iniquities and then seeing the result, the resurrection. Isaiah 53, verse 12, therefore I will divide with him a portion with the great. He shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bore the sin of many, and made intercession for their transgressions. In Mark 15, verses 27 and 28, this prophecy is referred to. With him they also crucified two robbers, one on his right, the other on his left. So the scripture was fulfilled, which said, and he was numbered with the transgressors. The whole chapter 53 of Isaiah, just one prophecy after another. You know, different people count it different ways. Some people say there's over 100 prophecies of Christ in the Old Testament. Others say it's about 60 or so. I've kind of looked at some of these lists. The ones that say that there's like 100 or more generally take one sentence. Like in Isaiah 53, you might count that as one prophecy, the whole chapter, or you might count it as about 15. And so it depends on how you break these things down. But there are a lot there. The other less well-known one is Psalm 22. Let's look at just a couple of passages here in Psalm 22. Verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? Of course, in Matthew 27, verse 46, about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Clearly, although it may not have looked like it at that time, back when David wrote it, he was making a prophecy about Christ when he wrote that. He may not have realized he was inspired by God. And this whole psalm, Psalm 22, is about Christ's death and crucifixion. Just a couple of other verses here, but it's the whole psalm. All those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip. They shake their head, saying, he trusted in the Lord. Let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. As we see, read through this, this could be talking about David. But in Matthew 27, verses 41 through 43, likewise, the chief priest also mocking with the scribes and elders said, he saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the king of Israel, let him come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. That's exactly what they said, what is described in Psalm 22. And then in verse 16, of Psalm 22, for the dogs have surrounded me, the congregation of the wicked has endorsed me, they pierce my hands and my feet. Was David's hands ever pierced? Was his feet ever pierced? Could not be referring to David. And while maybe it was not understood down through the centuries since that psalm was written exactly what it was referred to, at this time, the New Testament, the apostles, they knew, they saw it, they understand. Christ had prepared them to see just that. Luke 23, verse 33, and when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on his right hand and the other on his left. Psalm 22:18, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. fulfilled in Matthew 27, verse 35. Then they crucified him, divided his garments, casting lots that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And we could go on with a lot of passages like this, but all of these point to no one other than Jesus Christ. So it's hard to deny that. So the only thing that skeptics could say is, yeah, but there was really no Jesus Christ. They made up all this. Really? They would make up all this? Is that what they would do? Was there a vast conspiracy to defy Christ? Was there? You know, would that happen? You know, the disciples, they witnessed it all. Would they have put up with it all being fake? You know, would they have made it up for a fake Messiah? Would they have done that? What did they do? They dedicated their lives to what? Fulfilling the mission that Christ gave them. They gave their whole lives to that. A number of them were martyred. Very few lived long lives. Would they have done that for a fake? It makes no sense, does it? It simply doesn't make sense. They were in prison, martyrdom constantly. You know, that was their life. Yet here we are, 2,000 years later, with the knowledge that was passed down about Jesus Christ from the prophets, Genesis, all the way down to the present time. We have that. And we know it's accurate because we have Christ's Word, the Old Testament's accurate. We have the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have the Aleppo Codex. They all say that from that time forward, no changes. They're pretty much accurate. No substantial changes at all. Now, so the prophecies do prove God. But this is only the beginning. So I'm going to come back, and you might be surprised that I'm going to give a part two here. But I'm going to come back, and I'm going to give another sermon where we look at some other Old Testament prophecies that have been fulfilled and are being fulfilled right now as I speak, continuing to be filled. So we'll do that next time I speak. Thank you.